Hello, Happy New Year everyone, and welcome back to the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. In today's episode, I interview one of my most hotly anticipated guests, the Mandarin educator, blogger and teacher, Ollie Linger. Ollie is well known for being the founder of the blog Hacking Chinese. For over a decade, he's been drawing on his extensive experience of learning and teaching Chinese to offer tips and advice for other learners. If you've ever Googled anything related to learning Mandarin, it's likely you'll have encountered his blog towards the top of the search results. His own Mandarin journey began all the way back in 2007 when he studied Chinese at university. This was followed by 2 years studying in Taiwan, after which he completed a Masters of Education program in his native Sweden, focusing on teaching English and Chinese. Ollie returned to Taiwan in 2012 for a two-year master's program for teaching Chinese as a second language, and since returning to Sweden in 2014, he's been working mostly at university teaching Chinese and professional development to language teachers. In this interview, we had a wide-ranging conversation covering his insights into learning tones, criticisms of conventional teaching methods, and thoughts on the future of self-directed online language learning at a time when the numbers of people registering on formal university Chinese studies courses are in decline globally. Okay, so Ollie, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So to start with, I wanted to ask you a question I ask a lot of my guests, which is, how did you first get into learning Chinese?
Yeah, so this was a little bit of a, I wouldn't say it's random, but it's a lot of incidental things happening and occasional things that made me end up where I am now. But it started with an interest in Chinese philosophy and, well, a little bit of Chinese culture and history. And I started practicing Tai Chi Quan or Tai Chi in 2000. And that put me in contact with these things, and I got interested in Taoism and Chinese philosophy. And then many years later, in 2007, I got an opportunity to study 1 year of Chinese at university. And I said, well, I mean, why not give it a try? So I did that, and I got stuck. So I'm still here. I'm not learning Chinese actively right now, of course, but I'm working with it, and it's a big part of what I do.
Perfect. And if you take me back to those first couple of years, do you remember what you found most challenging, some of the main challenges that you faced during that time?
Well, my first few years were quite different from each other. So the first year was, I would say, fairly traditional, but rather intensive university studies. So, well, it's different in different countries and different universities and so on. But I think it's fairly representative of what many people do when they study Chinese for the first time at university. And then after that, I went to Taiwan and studied full-time for 2 years. And that was obviously different from what I did in Sweden, so the problems I faced were also quite different. I think in hindsight, this has helped me a lot to understand what challenges different students face. It's not like I only did one thing, so that's the only thing I know. But I would say in the classroom or formal course setting, one of the major issues is that the goals of the course, they are not necessarily aligned with either what I want, and maybe I wasn't even very clear what I wanted back then, but it's not necessarily the same thing as getting good at Chinese, whatever that means, or learning Chinese to a certain level where you can do the things you want. The university system and schools in general live kind of their own lives, so you can get very good grades, and I got very good grades during my first year, but that does not mean I actually learned as much as I could, and there were many things I did not learn. So after a year, you could imagine that, well, if you study full time, you should be able to get pretty far. And I've seen many other students get pretty far in that time. And I did learn a lot, but there were many things I didn't learn. There was a lot of focus on, say, you know, the traditional things such as vocabulary, reading, and things like that. But I wasn't very good at communicating, I would say. I had a very good foundation, so when I started to speak more, I learned pretty quickly. But I remember arriving in Taiwan after having studied for about a year then, and I really struggled with even basic things such as explaining clearly where I lived. I would say after a year, you should be able to do that. I remember thinking that was difficult. And it wasn't hard because I didn't know the words or the grammar. It was difficult because I hadn't been in many genuine communicative situations. And maybe that's one of the major drawbacks then with, well, formal education as it is mostly practiced. There are exceptions, of course. But I would say that was the main challenge. Like, actually communicating was not part of the curriculum.
And at some point then you began blogging about these issues that you were facing. Do you remember when it was that you specifically started blogging, and what was it that initially motivated you to begin the Hacking Chinese blog?
So when I learned Chinese here in Sweden, and then when I went to Taiwan and started learning Chinese there full time in various language schools and universities, I kept noticing things that didn't make sense. And in the beginning, I didn't really think too much about this. I was halfway through like a teacher's education, so I knew some things. I mean, I had some theoretical background, but not a lot. And I noticed things that didn't make sense to me. And in the beginning, I thought maybe this is just the way it is and I'm just, you know, wrong, or I don't have all the knowledge, I don't know the background and so on, so maybe I'm just mistaken. But the more I did this, the more I realized that things are not actually done in a very, you know, reasonable and efficient way. There are many oddities and weird things about how Chinese is taught, well, both at universities in the West and in immersion environments too, because I was thinking, okay, I go to Taiwan, everything will be fine. People here know how to teach the language. It's what they do. There are lots of people here who learn Chinese and it will be fine. But there were lots of issues there too. And I started thinking about these more and more and what I could do about them, how I could improve. And then at some point I decided that, yeah, why not write about this? And I've been writing about things that I do longer than I've had Hacking Chinese. But then after I left Taiwan, which was in 2010, so after 2 years, I thought it would be a good idea to convert things I'd written on my personal blog to focus only on writing about Chinese, because I thought it was very interesting. And yeah, that's how Hacking Chinese was born. Well, I've been writing about this ever since, and feels like a very long time now. But yeah, when you're in it, it doesn't really feel like that. Time goes fast.
Absolutely. And that blog has since become one of the most widely read resources online about Chinese learning. And I remember one of the first blogs that I came across, blog post that you wrote, was about one of these issues that you'd obviously noticed, which was about the third tone. So the blog was all about how third tone tends to be mistaught as this falling and rising tone, but in most cases, native speakers actually just pronounce it as a low tone, except for a few exceptions. Why do you think it is that things like this, which are really quite simple and the way you explained it made perfect sense, why do you think that these aspects tend to be taught so badly?
That's a good question. And I mean, it's hard to know, of course, but I do think this is tied to tradition. Things are taught in a specific way because that's the way somebody taught me, and then I bring that to my students. This is very true if you talk about language education in Chinese-speaking context, like in China, Taiwan, or something like that, because people don't have a first-hand experience of what it's like to learn the language, so they just have to trust their teachers and their educational programs that they are doing it right. And if they're doing it in one way, I'm going to do it in that way. I don't have this first-hand experience, I don't know how to do this, and therefore I just keep doing what everybody else does. And in the West, I think the problem might be the kind of the opposite, that the people who teach, either they are in the same category as the people who teach in China, that they are native speakers and they've learned from another native speaker, or it's foreigners, I mean, like us. And the problem there is that maybe most foreigners don't really care that much. They don't get far enough that they actually are willing to teach and do all these things. It's rarely that you have a combination of these, and that's what's required to see things like this. Like, many people can say, yeah, I have a problem with the third tone, maybe. And if you read up on it a bit, you might see, okay, well, actually, it's not a dipping tone. But taking the step there from trying to think of, okay, how should I teach this? It requires you to have gone through a lot of thoughts before you get there. And then trying to redesign how you teach something is quite hard. I can give you another example, which is not tone related, which is kind of shows the same thing. So when I teach, let's say, ch, ch, sh, so the ZH, CH, and SH, if you want to explain this to someone who's struggling with them, for example, for some reason, the traditional order to say these syllables is like I said them, ch, ch, sh. That is the order they are said in Chinese. I've never heard any Chinese teachers say them in any other order, to the point that I myself think that it sounds odd to say them in any other way. And I've studied a ton of phonetics and phonology in Chinese in grad school, and it's just the way it's done. Nobody thinks about it. And when the teachers teach students, that's what they do too. But when you think about it, this is also a bit weird. So the ch here, the ZH, that's the hardest sound of these three, I would argue, for most people. And then we have the ch, which is the same, but with aspiration. And then we have the sh. The point is that the SH sound is the basic sound that is in the all the other sounds, and it's the easiest one. But you get there last. So instead of trying to get students to say the easiest thing first and then build on that, you start with the hardest sound. And it's even worse when you get to say jcc, right? J-I-X-I-N-Q-I. Why do you start with J? I mean, J-I is really hard to say for most people, whereas X-I is pretty easy in comparison, at least. So we have this because this is the way it's done, we keep doing it in this order, even though it doesn't make much sense. And I think this is true for the third tone as well. We just inherited one way of doing it, and most people don't think about, is this actually what makes most sense pedagogically? And sometimes, you know, it can be that pedagogically something makes sense, even though it's not 100% true. But in this case, if you read the phonology, the people who research Chinese tones in general, most of them actually describe the third tone as a low tone. So this is not just a pedagogical trick to make it easier. This is actually how people understand and describe the third tone outside Chinese teacher circles, that is. Maybe the main problem for a vast majority of teachers is that they simply have zero training in phonetics. Actually zero. It depends a little bit who your teacher is, of course. If they have like a master's degree in teaching Chinese, they have definitely studied some phonetics. But most of the Chinese teachers I've encountered, and I teach courses for professional development courses for Chinese teachers here in Sweden, so I meet quite a lot of teachers, they have no training at all in this area. And that has some serious consequences, because native speakers can, of course, speak their own language. That goes without saying. But the thing is, having an understanding, a theoretical understanding of how you speak is quite important when you teach something. And the third tone here we can use as a very good example of this. So I am fully aware of what I'm saying most of the time when I'm saying it in Chinese. And Chinese is not my native language, so of course I have had to study that. And I would be a lousy teacher in Swedish. I don't know nothing, but I don't know a lot about Swedish phonology. It's just I've never studied it. So when it comes to the third tone then, a good example here is, as we've said, it's a low tone. Most of the time. The only time it is a dipping tone is when you stress it, or when you say it like in isolation and want to speak clearly. Like if I want to say, you know, no, it's not four, it's ooh, five. I want to make it really clear that it's five and not something else. And when you do that, you have this dipping tone contour, right? And that's what students are taught. And the problem then is that how this third tone is pronounced is heavily dependent on rate of speech. If I speak at a natural, normal pace, and I say a word like Meiguo, America, right? It is a low tone, and there is no dispute here. There is no one who studies Chinese pronunciation who thinks there is anything else. Meiguo is just low, or low falling if you want to be very picky about it. But it certainly has no rise. It is not a dipping tone. However, if you're a teacher and you don't know about phonology at all, you don't know this. So what you're going to do is that when your student makes a mistake here, they say Meiguo, which is what, 80% of Americans who study Chinese say, the teacher is going to say, no, you did that wrong. It's supposed to be Mei.
That's exactly what happened to
and
me.
Exactly. And I listened to one of the interviews. I forgot who the person you interviewed with his name, but he also mentioned this, that he felt he was tone deaf. And it's a little bit because teachers say one thing and they don't realize that when they say Meiguo and when they say Meiguo, they're saying two different things. They're changing the pronunciation. And then when they start speaking again, they're suddenly saying Meiguo again with a low tone. And the student is like, you're saying different things. And most students are not aware enough to actually notice that. They just feel that they are stupid, they are tone deaf or something. And the teacher is not aware of the fact that they are changing their pronunciation. And this is why teachers don't need to teach phonetics. Like they don't have to teach students IPA and, you know, the basics of phonology and so on. But it's important that the teacher knows this so they understand what they are saying themselves, because this is a clear illustration of that when students can feel or become misled because, well, the teacher isn't aware of their own pronunciation.
I also think like often native speaker teachers or native speakers in general, their perception of the phonetics when they haven't studied it can be quite stubborn. So, I've had back and forth with native speakers where I'm trying to explain to them this reality about the phonetics of third tone, but they persist in thinking like, no, I'm sure there's a rise. Like even in just a third tone, fourth tone pair, they still swear that they can hear a rise, even though obviously like there isn't one, but yeah. I wanted to move on to talking about tones in general then. So this is something that seems to be quite controversial still in the Chinese learning community, Chinese teaching community, which is about the importance or lack of importance of tones. And I think we're definitely on the same page on this. I recently wrote a blog about the importance of tones for being understood at the intermediate to advanced levels. And I got some pushback on this idea from people who kind of still believe that you don't need tones in order to be understood. You can be understood without tones. And I remember reading one of your blogs that was called "The Importance of Tones is Inversely Proportional to the Predictability of What You Say." I was wondering if you could explain a bit more what you meant by that.
So when we listen, we rely on several different processes to handle the things we hear, right? So we have bottom-up processing, which is essentially when you try to extract information from the sounds, you synthesize syllables, you connect them to things in your long-term memory, and you build upwards towards some kind of understanding. And this is what most people think that listening ability is all about. Like, isn't that what listening is? I mean, extracting information from the spoken audio, that's what listening is. But actually, no. That is not what listening is, because we also have top-down processing, and that's when you do the opposite. You start with some kind of understanding, expectations, or you base it off knowledge you already have, and then you try to interpret what you hear. And these two go on in parallel all the time. So when we speak, how important, you know, things like mistakes in general, this is true for accuracy overall, it would be the same for grammar or some initial or final issue with pronunciation or word choice or something else. Essentially, if the listener has the information they need to correctly interpret what you say, even if you make a mistake, of course it's going to be fine. If someone can see you standing, you know, on the curb and you're having your luggage and you look like you're looking for a cab and a cab pulls up and you know, you say something, you want to go to someplace. Whatever you say here, the driver kind of knows that, okay, it's a foreigner, he's got lots of luggage. Well, he seems to be going to probably the airport. So it doesn't matter what tones you use for something like 机场, or if you mess up some other part of that sentence, or like, I want to go here or something. They will understand what you mean almost regardless of what you say. You could actually say nothing and you would probably end up where you wanted, right? You don't need tones. You don't need to say things even. This is because they know what you want in advance. They can use contextual clues to figure out what you want. And if you made a mistake, that's not the whole world, because they kind of can work around that. If we take the opposite example, then we have the same situation. So you're hailing a cab for some reason, but this time you don't want to go to the airport. You want to go to a friend's place, and they live in some street that isn't like a main street or something. And assuming then that this driver actually knows the streets, which, I mean, many cab drivers actually do, if you say the name of this street incorrectly, even with one tone off, it's very likely that they will not understand what you say. I haven't experienced this myself, but I have two people I know who have experienced it, exactly this situation, where you actually have to write down the name because you get the tones wrong and the driver is blank. I have no idea what street you're talking about. And you write it down and he says, ah, you mean this. And they say, yeah, that's what we said. And he said, well, yeah, but you got the tones wrong, right? Or a personal name is the same thing, if it's not a celebrity. You cannot mess up anything here. If you do, people will not understand. And that is, of course, because if there are like thousands of streets to choose from, it's very difficult to know which one you mean if you make a mistake. Whereas if you're going to the airport, you know in advance. So in the one case, you rely on what you already know, the top-down processing, and then tones are not very important, and nothing is important actually. You just need to get roughly the right things out of your mouth and you'll be fine. In the other case, the listener cannot rely on these processes to figure out what you're saying. So the only option they have is to listen to what you actually say and try to, as I said before, extract this information from the Chinese you say.
Right. And one of the issues that I have with this is that at the beginner level, a large proportion of what you say is going to be in the category of things which are very predictable and can be understood through context. And so one thing that ends up happening, and actually ended up happening to me, is that when people tell you about the importance of tones and they say you can't really be understood properly unless you have good tones, it kind of rings hollow, because my lived experience was, well, I can, because I'm saying these things and people are clearly responding appropriately and understanding. I was recently reading a paper about this that basically it was analyzing beginner learners, and it found that they can be understood without tones. I was kind of thinking as I was reading it that that's exactly the problem. Beginner learners can be understood without tones, and so it lulls them into this false sense of security. Is that something that you agree with?
Yes, and I think it's not only, I mean, what the examples we've used so far illustrate this problem, but a more common one that I think almost all learners have experienced is that you understand what one person is saying, and this is usually your teacher or whomever you're talking most with. They understand what you say, but nobody else does. So you have this false sense of security. You're talking with your teacher, you understand what they say, they understand what you say. And then when you talk to somebody else, you go to China, you encounter a Chinese person in your home country, and you say something, and they just stare at you. They have no idea what you're saying. And teachers are extremely good at understanding beginners who garble their pronunciation. That's their job, essentially. And I think that's a good thing. It makes it possible to speak and have conversations at an earlier level and so on. But if you're not aware of this as a student, you will get a shock when you step outside of the classroom or talk with somebody else, because they don't have the knowledge that this teacher has. Because, for example, think about it. If I teach a beginner, I know almost exactly which words this beginner knows. I can talk in a way that uses 99% of the words they have, and as soon as I say something that I know we haven't covered because I've taught them, I know there is a little bell going off in my head and say, this thing they probably haven't learned. And I'm fully aware of these things when I teach. And this means that when they speak to me, I know exactly what they're going to say, or I know what they can say. I know the range of possible things they can say. And that means that even if they get the tones wrong or something else wrong, I can usually understand what they say. It's the same thing. I can rely on my prior knowledge, on things that are not in the things they are saying. I can rely on that to understand and interpret what they're saying. But if you encounter someone on the street who knows nothing about you, they don't have this knowledge and they cannot predict what you're going to say, and therefore they are not going to understand. All learners have at some point experienced the frustration of being able to speak with one person quite well and then talking with a stranger and not being understood.
Yeah, although these are often kind of experiences that you get later on. It's sort of like, I'm wondering how we convince the beginner learners, because this is something I've had issues with both in my own learning and then later on trying to convince new learners about the importance of tones. Because if you haven't had like the first-hand experience, the kinds of things that we're talking about can come across as overly severe. I remember when I first started learning Chinese, I went through this kind of beginner phase of not really believing that tones were that important. And I've since found it very difficult to persuade other people. And I've kind of watched this slow car crash happen several times that happened to me. So I'm wondering, like, how have you found trying to convince new learners of what we're saying about tones?
So, I mean, we have both been through this ourselves. And I think that's quite different from having someone who hasn't, like a native speaker, saying this. And that's something I think is quite important in general. So native speakers are very good at some things, and I will never be as good as the best native speakers when it comes to using, say, natural language at a level which is appropriate for the student. That is something which is very hard to learn. But then again, second language learners like us have certain advantages that native speakers don't. So ideally, I think we need to have both kinds of teachers. And I think that can help. If you say, I experienced this myself, trust me, that is quite different from someone saying, this is the way it is. I try to use these types of examples. And I also have another one that I've tried a few times. I don't know what it's like if you have this in English, but in Swedish, we have, you know, kids play around with languages. And one of the things we do is you replace all the vowels with I or I. So we call it the I language or I-språket in Swedish. So it will be a little bit like speaking English like this. And I'm using only a single vowel here, right? So you can hear what I'm talking here. You understand what I'm saying, I think. Okay. And the follow-up question is, do you think that if I, as a second language learner of English, do you think I should ignore vowels just because you were able to understand when I replaced all of them with the same one? I mean, the obvious answer is no, right? You can't do that. It's like, do you think spelling is important? Well, most people would say, yeah, sort of. And that doesn't mean that, you know, one spelling mistake will make people unable to read what you write, but nobody will draw the conclusion that you can spell however you want just because of that, right? When teaching, I'm trying to use these types of examples to either use things in their own language and say, like, okay, what's it like when people speak like this in your language? And then generally have a discussion about these things. In my experience, I haven't encountered many students who just refuse. But then again, if I'm teaching and it's a formal course, they don't have much choice. Like, I decide if tones are important or not. But, you know, you get students who ask, when I write pinyin, do I need to use tones? And this question is very indicative of this issue, right? If you're asking this question, it means you haven't really understood what you're doing. It's like, do you need to write other vowels in English? Well, yes, you need to write other vowels. It's obvious, right?
I wanted to pick up on something that you said at the beginning of the interview, which was about your early experiences of formal education, formal courses in Chinese. And this is something that I've heard a lot from people who've taken Chinese at university level, which is that often the courses are not structured around what you want to achieve. So you have certain goals in mind that might be, for example, to become fluent in the spoken language in Chinese. And then the course is kind of structured in a way that takes you almost away from that, makes you study things that you're not as interested in. I'm wondering how, like, since you've kind of entered formal education on the other side of it and teaching, how you've kind of tried to remedy that situation.
So, I mean, this problem is not unique to Chinese, of course. I think this is many of these things exist at universities because of, again, tradition. I mean, languages used to be taught in order to be able to, say, translate classical texts from, say, Latin or Greek or something. And then those methods have kind of been inherited down the line. And of course, we don't teach the way we did in, you know, 100 years ago at university, and things are considerably better now, but still not, I would say, up to date or anywhere close. And I think there are several issues at work here. You will never be able to find a course that matches exactly what you want to learn unless you are the only student in it. That's just the necessity of organizing courses for many people. You need to find some middle way that kind of works for everybody. Especially if we're talking about a formal educational system where you have credits and there are some requirements for assessment. You have to be able to show that you have reached a certain level. We can't just give out grades for free and things like that. The formal education system is, to a large extent, about control too. It's about making sure students know what the course syllabus says they have to know and things like that. And if you're an individual student and your goal is to learn the language, not to get credits, you don't necessarily care about these things. You do care about your ability or your proficiency in the language, but you don't really care about the exact metrics that the university happens to use to measure this. And I think that's the fundamental issue. There's a lot of inertia in the system, and it's hard to change that we test things in a certain way. For example, most formal courses in Chinese focus more on the written language than the spoken language. And if you ask teachers, I don't think it's that they say, well, the written language is better, or, you know, it somehow should have a higher priority. I don't think that's the case, but it's just the way it is historically, and it's just the way it is now. If you have a syllabus, you inherit it from your institution, and they say, hey, teach this course, here's the syllabus. And, you know, it specifies there is a written exam, but there is no oral exam. The courses I took in Chinese, and those were quite good, I should say. I'm not trying to say that my teachers didn't do a good job or anything. I think my teachers were very good. But the problem was that most of the assessments were simply written. And then, of course, if students care about their grades, or if they don't have enough drive on their own to go online and look for other ways of doing things and so on, they will just do what is required. And then they will, of course, focus more on the written language, because that's what's going to come on the exam. As a teacher, I think, depending on how much power you have over what you're doing, you can do different things. So if I teach students individually, which I rarely do, then of course I base everything off what they want. I figure out what they want to do, what do they want to use Chinese for, and where are they now, and how can we get from A to B. But when you're working at a university, for example, or even in a language school or some smaller institution, you have lots of other things to worry about. I mean, for example, so you're going to teach this course, here's the syllabus, and you say, okay, I can work with the syllabus, I can introduce more speaking if I want to, I can try to do things in a more reasonable or better way, whatever that means. But then they say, okay, you have, you know, at university here, maybe you get 18 students, okay, and you get 80 hours. Go. And then he realized that, okay, I wanted to kind of rebuild this whole thing from scratch and do the right thing. But I mean, I'm not getting paid to do that. And if I do that for all the courses I have, I'm going to end up with an 80-hour work week. And not everybody's willing to do that. And that's, maybe you shouldn't do that. I mean, we can blame teachers for lots of things. And I think sometimes rightly so. I mean, we bash teachers for their lack of knowledge in phonetics and so on earlier. But I want to make it clear too that, I mean, teachers have specific restraints they are operating within. And many of these problems are not their problems as individuals. If they've been through an education that didn't teach them this, maybe it's not their fault, it's their education's fault. And if they don't have the time to tailor the learning to suit the students better, maybe it's not their fault, maybe it's the institution's fault. That's something I've realized when teaching myself, but also when working with professional development for teachers, is that there are lots of things that you as a student don't really see and don't realize. Especially I'm thinking of the period when we talked about earlier when I started hacking Chinese. I was sometimes, I shouldn't say angry, I'm not really an angry person, but I was a little bit annoyed because I had this third tone issue we talked about, so it's a very personal thing for me too. I used to say mei guo, and so then somebody, after I'd studied for roughly 2 years, I would say, somebody said, hey, Ulla, you're doing this wrong. Like, do you know that your tone here is wrong? And I said, no, what do you mean? And then they said, no, it's supposed to be mei guo, slowly like that, with like a low tone first. And I'm like, no way, I cannot have done this for, you know, 2 years, and nobody literally nobody has told me about this. It's not possible, right? I'd rather believe that you are wrong than that nobody has told me this, right? Of course, they were right, and I spent an awful lot of time trying to fix this. And you feel a little certain kind of, you know, irritation. Why didn't anybody tell me this? But the people to blame here, I don't think, is it's not the individual teachers. What I've realized working with this from the other end is that this is often not the individual's fault, I think. It's a larger problem that has to do with, you know, how teacher education is organized, or if the teacher even has a teacher education, and how much time they get in their courses. And there are many other things that play into this. So what I'm saying is, don't blame your teacher, blame the system.
Right. Yeah, and we had a podcast episode which was all about Chinese politeness as well, which I think comes into it. Because a lot of teachers come from a culture where it's not really polite to directly point out other people's flaws, especially when you don't know those people very well. And so this comes into play, I think, quite a lot in terms of the teacher-student relationship. I wanted to ask as well about a recent report in the Times, which is relevant to what we're discussing, which is that fewer and fewer people in the UK, at least, and I think this is also a global trend, are enrolling on Chinese studies courses at university. And I wanted to know from you what you think the reason for this is, and also what you think the solutions might be.
Yeah, so I think it's a global trend in general, and it's not even specific to Chinese, even though I think Chinese maybe has been affected a little bit more than other languages. But I mean, across Europe, at least, we do see fewer students being interested in learning languages other than English. And maybe, like I said, I don't know the numbers for all countries, obviously, but I do think that Chinese has probably been more affected than many other languages. And I used to follow these numbers fairly closely for Sweden, because it's part of my job at the university. And we had our peak in 2010 or 11, I think. I mean, I'm talking about junior and senior high school here. So university, I'm not so sure about. We don't have as clear statistics there. But there is certainly a downward trend since about 2010. And I think it should be the same in the UK. We had lots of people being interested around the Olympics, and that made lots of people interested. And then after that, it's kind of gone downhill. Part of it is, what do we use languages for? We can clearly say that, yeah, I mean, learning Chinese or other languages is beneficial. There are lots of studies that show that, you know, industry needs people who can interact with people from other countries, and it facilitates business communications and, you know, collaborations and so on. But that's not the way people who are, you know, 15 think. They think more like, do I want to go here on vacation? Is this a cool language? Is it, what do my friends do? And if your friends are not studying Chinese and you don't feel like going to China on vacation because you can't because of COVID or I don't know anything else, then Chinese maybe isn't your first choice. So it's a lot more about how people perceive the language. Do they see themselves as someone learning and using Chinese or maybe living in China? And back in 2000, the answer to that question was clearly different from what it is now. And that has to do with, well, lots of factors. I mean, geopolitics and many other things. So I don't think there is a single answer here, and it is a complicated one. What's your take on it? I mean, your post about this.
So one thing I'm wondering about is like whether we should separate these two different things, which is one of them is like enrollment in university and the other one is engagement with the Chinese language in general. If we rewind to kind of the era that you're talking about, so 2000, 20 years ago, I think at that point, if you wanted to learn Chinese, then probably enrolling on a university studies course was, if not the only option, then really like probably the most solid option, especially if you get to like study in China and that kind of thing. And I think now in the past 10 years with the past couple of decades with obviously the rise of the internet and just how the availability of content and also learning advice and all that kind of thing, for the first time we've started to see people actually reaching like decent levels without the aid of formal study. And I think that's kind of a trend. I think it's still relatively small, but I think it's big enough that we can no longer make the assumption that like people enrolling on Chinese studies courses make up the entirety or like the vast majority of overall number of people who are interested in or are serious about learning Chinese. There are more people out there. So I think for me, like I'm wondering whether in terms of the future, this self-directed study might play a bigger role. And I know that you're kind of involved in like both formal education level of teaching at universities, but you also have created your own courses, helping people, giving them the kind of tools they need in order to learn Chinese for themselves, right? And that's kind of what I'm involved in as well. And I'm wondering whether going forward, given the drop in numbers of on these courses, whether that might play a bigger role.
I think it's reasonable to assume that more people are learning Chinese on their own or more independently. And I would say that the whole point of hacking Chinese is to, well, I would say it's to create people or create independent students or students who are more independent than they were before. So, and I think that's part of your goal as well. Like you shouldn't rely, I don't think you should rely on other people to make important decisions for you about something that matters mostly to you. I mean, your teacher might care a little bit about how you're doing, but it's ultimately your learning and your life. And then I think you should be in charge. So this independent learning is something you should be doing regardless of. I mean, I see formal education as a tool and as a learning resource among all the others. And it has certain benefits and it has certain drawbacks. And it can provide some things, but not others. So I'm not for or against formal education as such. For a large majority of students, they do need some kind of structure. Most people are not independent enough. And this could be they lack knowledge, they lack motivation, they haven't thought about it or whatever. But if you just give them, you know, do whatever you want, they will end up doing something else. And this completely self-directed learning when you basically, yeah, do whatever you want kind of approach doesn't really work for a majority of people in general. There are people who it works for really well. And you see the best example of those, well, people you've interviewed on this podcast, for example, or, you know, you have lots of people who learn Chinese independently. And I think you've learned Chinese mostly independently yourself, right? Yeah. And so there are lots of examples. But I think a problem here is that we're seeing the examples where this worked. It's kind of a survivorship bias thing. All the people who quit learning Chinese independently are never counted, and they don't go on podcasts and they don't talk about how they didn't learn Chinese. So I think it's easy to overestimate how good a method this is for the average student, if you will. If we want to make large numbers of people learn languages, I think it needs to be partly within institutions such as schools. But I do think that formal education plays this role of giving people structure. And, you know, if you take a course at university, you will learn certain things. You will read a lot, you will get some grammar, you will get to speak some, you will need to listen a bit and so on. So you are learning certain things. And it provides a structure, you have a textbook, you are supposed to do this before Friday and so on. And most people need this kind of structure. And like I said, the structure is not perfect. You can even argue that it's deeply flawed in several areas. But without the structure, I mean, the alternative would then be to say, go to Hacking Chinese or I'm learning Mandarin and do whatever these guys online say. But the problem is, of course, that most people never go there and they never will. And the people who are listening to this conversation have already selected themselves as being interested in this kind of independent, self-driven way of learning. And if you show these things or you play these podcast episodes to average high school students, very few are actually going to care. I mean, it's sad to say, but that's just the way it is. So if we want to make not just the self-selected, those who are already inclined to be somewhat independent and self-driven, if you want to make them learn languages too, I think we do need institutions and formal education. I think formal education has a role to play. Maybe not for the people who are listening to this episode, but for the people who aren't.
That makes sense. One thing I would pick up on is when I talk about self-directed study, I'm absolutely not talking about, you know, total anarchy without any kind of structure. It's kind of the opposite. Like all of the best self-directed students that I've ever interviewed for this podcast, anyone who's had any success has absolutely, like, structure has been like core to that. So I guess we're agreed on the importance of structure, and then the only question remaining is how do we get people to structure their Chinese studies in a way that's beneficial to them, in a way that works. Where we may slightly disagree is that increasingly online content may have a bigger role to play in that. I'm thinking, for example, of like this has played out more in the Japanese community than it learning community than it has in the Chinese learning community. But there was like a pretty successful movement in Japanese called, I don't know if you heard of it, it was called All Japanese All the Time, and it was like we have to always bear in mind that when we're talking about this, it's a niche area, like learning Japanese or learning Chinese. It's never gonna reach the kind of numbers that you would if you were, you know, talking about football. But within the limits of learning Japanese, this was like quite a successful endeavor. And whether we agree with the methods or not, there were like it did motivate quite large numbers of people to basically self-study Japanese, and most of them were not doing that in terms of formal education. So I kind of think that The question boils down to how eventually do we provide that structure for people? And there's different ways that can be done. And one of them is certainly formal education. And I also think in the future, increasingly, there will probably be a role for non-formal education to do that as well in a way that probably wasn't the case 20 years ago in the past, and certainly before the internet.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, I think that even if you are in formal, I mean, you're enrolled in a course somewhere, to do well with Chinese and not with your course now, you have to be independent. You have to do all these things we're talking about. So this is not like optional. I don't think it's like you do formal education or you do independent learning. You should do, if you're in a formal course, you need to take responsibility yourself and do these other things too. All these extra resources and methods that are floating around online are very good. I mean, I'm not saying the methods themselves are necessarily good, but the fact that they are out there and that people are discussing and sharing their experiences with learning and using these methods is very, very good, because, you know, you can use this as a supplement to what you're doing in class and so on. And I don't think we are disagreeing here. I also think that this is more increasingly important. My point is that when we start having methods where you can, you know, say, I'm doing this method and I'll follow the instructions they have here, and I know that people have done well. And we're starting to see that, right? I mean, there are such methods. And like I said, we can argue all day if they are, the methods themselves are good or not. But that's the kind of approach we would need online to be able to make up for the loss of, in quotation marks here, formal education. Because I'm the kind of person, you've read my blog, and I seldom say, you know, I don't give just a yes or a no to an answer. If somebody says, should I do this? It's probably, it depends. And then I try to explain, okay, what does it depend on? And the reason I do that is because, I mean, I don't want to answer questions for one student, especially not in writing or on the podcast. I want to answer it so that other people who read this or listen to it can apply the reasoning, and then they might end up with a different answer. So that's why I'm not giving these simple answers. But that's what people want. People ask this all the time. Yeah, fine, you said all this, but what do you want me to do? Can you give me this roadmap where I can say, one, do this, do 30 minutes of this every day, go to this website, do these exercises. This is the type of input that people want, but I'm normally not willing to give. And that's not because I think it's bad, but people do need this type of structure. That's what I meant when I said structure earlier. So courses, like a formal course, it tells you, you have this exam, we're using this book, you have to do this, 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 and this. There is like a, you know, some kind of study guide that says, this is how you, what we do in our course, this is how you do your homework, this is how you practice, and you do these things. And we can recreate a similar kind of support structure online, and that is a good thing. That means we can tailor it more to what people actually want to do. We don't have to care about the traditions of a specific institution. We don't have to care about someone somewhere else having designed a national curriculum or something else. So just to clarify, I think we are mostly on the same page there. I'm just saying that let's not forget about the people who don't even go online and search for these things. That's what I'm saying.
One final point that I wanted to move on to was something we briefly touched on, but I wanted to get your opinion on in slightly more depth, which is you mentioned one of the issues with formal education that you found was proficiency testing. This is also one of my main issues with formal education as I see it, which is that almost all like formal courses have some kind of proficiency tests, and I absolutely hate proficiency tests. I've taken HSK3, I took that about 4 years ago. I felt that studying towards HSK3 basically took me away from studying Chinese. It's kind of difficult to do, but the tasks involved are not the same as what you need in terms of to actually be able to use Chinese, which is something you've mentioned. How do you solve this problem then? Presumably you have to create some kind of testing. So how do you do it so that it doesn't take students away? It doesn't give them kind of pointless tasks that they have to perform that won't be useful?
So that is, again, I mean, we talked about tests a little bit earlier, right? In the sense of tests in a formal course, which is a bit different from a proficiency test, right? But I think, I mean, tests have different functions. I'm not necessarily sure people need proficiency tests at all. They are nice in the sense that you can benchmark your own learning. I used to take the Taiwanese, the TOCFL, all the time because they had like pilot versions that were free and they were testing out new levels or whatever. So I did them, I don't know, once a semester, and that was great to get some kind of, yeah, okay, this is how I'm doing with reading. Beyond that, I don't see much use. I don't like proficiency tests either. Like you said, they test largely the wrong things. People mistake a good result for being good at Chinese, which is just, I mean, delusionary. You can have people who, I mean, you can read very well, you can be good at listening, but if you cannot navigate a conversation, it might all be useless. You can't use the language. Well, we also have all the problems with the practice effect. If you have, you know, studied this type of multiple choice questions a lot, you'll get really good at answering this type of question, but not so much other types of questions. So I think proficiency tests ideally should be used only when you need to prove your proficiency to somebody else. And that is exceedingly rare. I've only had to do that once in my whole life. And that was when I enrolled in the graduate program for teaching Chinese as a second language. Because then we had to show that we knew Chinese in advance, because it was a core, I mean, the program is for native speakers. So you need to show that you have a decent level, otherwise they won't let you in. But that's the only time in, I don't know how long I've studied Chinese, 16 years, that I've been asked to prove this. Not even when I applied for my current job did anybody actually ask me for like a certificate of that kind. And I think people vastly overestimate how useful it is to have a certificate. Nobody really cares if you have a HSK, you know, 4 certificate. Maybe somebody cares if you have the highest level possible, because you can show that, you know, I know how to say more than ni hao, and then you have the certificate, and that's good. And if you want to study in China, like I said, with my master's program, mm-hmm. Yes, you need to be able to show you have a decent level. But for most students, you don't need this. This is not something you should care too much about. And caring too much about it, I think, can mm-hmm. be detrimental. You might think that, you know, vocabulary lists is the end all of language learning, because that's what's in the HSK documents. I mean, 90% of the document itself is just a list of words. And so that's the point.
Exactly. I mean, I sometimes give the example of, imagine if I suddenly, in this conversation, I suddenly asked you about a specific thing or fact or number that, like, I mentioned 5 minutes ago during the course of this conversation, and imagine you forgot or for some reason couldn't answer. What would that tell us about your English proficiency? Clearly nothing. But for some reason, that kind of exercise is prioritized above anything else when it comes to proficiency tests, at least for Chinese. So I couldn't agree more with kind of what you've just said. So I think that's a good note to end on then. So it's been super interesting to get your thoughts on these issues. So once again, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me, and thanks for providing all these resources for people who want to learn Chinese more independently.
Hey there, thanks for listening to this episode of the I'm Learning Mandarin podcast. If you're currently looking to improve your Mandarin speaking skills, you might like to check out my Peak Mandarin newsletter. Run by me and my friend Will Hart, we share exactly what you need to do to become fluent in Chinese based on our experience. Subscribe to the newsletter and we'll also send you a free copy of my ebook, Lessons from a Chinese Learning Phenomenon, which tells the story of exactly how Will Hart learned to speak near native level Chinese within a 1.5 year period, how I put his techniques into practice to become fluent myself, and how you can too. To subscribe to the newsletter, you can go to peakmandarin.com or click the link in the description. That's all for now. Until next episode, goodbye.